This morning I will be reading 1 Timothy 4:8. For bodily exercise profit little, but godliness is profitable unto all things, having promise of the life that now is and of what which is to come.
Good morning. Appreciate Dawson or Cole Jameson reading scripture for us this morning. Glad to see everybody here today, especially our visitors. We have several. We're happy to have you here. You're an honored guest. I said Dawson, that's because I was thinking about what I've got in my hand, which is a card from Dawson and Mary Kate Smith, because they got married yesterday, and they wanted to give this card to the church that said, "We would like to say a special thank you to the members here for the wonderful wedding gift, and thank you all for making us feel so welcomed and encouragement that you've showed to us. We're so blessed to have such a sweet church family. And Christian love, Dawson and Mary-Kate Smith." And we just want to say we love y'all. We're so happy for you, and we hope y'all just have a wonderful, wonderful life together. So excited for you. Having read that, we're getting into our lesson a little bit this morning. Thought about a little story I wanted to share with y'all today. I don't think I told anybody this last year. It was a bit of a funny experience. Well, I say funny. It was less funny at the time. But have you ever noticed how panic warps the mind? Like when you are panicking, the world seems to change real fast, your view of it. Last year, it was, I'm going to say, first week of May, somewhere around there. So, you know, being last year, everything was shut down just about. but it was around the first week of May, and I was sitting at home because I was working from home at the time, writing my sermons, recording videos for us, and I was reading my Bible, preparing a lesson, and I was looking at my Bible, and I was like, why is there something floating in my Bible? And I'm trying to move it. Like, it's not, but I look up at the sky and see something floating through my vision. I'm like, what is that? And, you know, just start panicking. Like, why do I see this weird thing floating in my vision? And call the eye doctor, set up they weren't even open at the time, but they gave me a little emergency appointment to check me out. I'm just panicking, you know, like, as a minister, my vision is fairly essential to doing my job. Like, you know, if it were my hearing, it might be different, but like, I need my vision just scared me to death. Turns out, very normal. Most of you probably know about this. Like, you get floaters in your eyes sometimes, which is fairly fine. You got little bee fibers back there, or little bee pieces of gel, I think, that kind of dislodge, and mostly it's fine. Like, you can have other problems, but like, that's okay. If you notice a bunch of them, go to your eye doctor. But, I met with my eye doctor. She's like, yeah, your eyes are fine. You have no problems. it's perfectly normal. But I remember just sitting there and reading and seeing it and panicking, going to the doctor and panicking and thinking, oh no, my eyes! No, can't have this problem. And it was during a time where everybody was kind of panicking anyway. And I go to the doctor and she checks me out and I'm like, oh, okay. Well, all right. No reason to panic. All calm and easy. You know, it's funny sometimes how we get scared and it looks very big and very difficult and then it can just go away. I thought about different things that tend to cause us anxiety. You know, for some people it's taxes. It's having any kind of deadline coming towards them and they get closer and closer to it and, you know, you maybe put it off or you don't get it done at the right time. It can get easy to spin off into panic of, I gotta get this done. It doesn't become, I need to get this done because it's my responsibility to get it done on time. But it can turn into, if I don't get it done, I'm gonna get in trouble. And if I get in trouble, I could go to jail. And if I go to jail, my life is over. You know, it can just kind of build up, you know, to, if I don't send off my taxes before April 15th, they will come hunt me down and put me in prison immediately. And it's like, you know, we get a little bit of stomach discomfort. We get on WebMD and it's like, oh no, I've got cancer. It's really easy sometimes to let panic drive you way past what's going on at the moment. I think about with pain, both emotional and physical. Sometimes we're in a little bit of pain, and that pain can be really difficult. But then it can be really difficult when we start thinking about consequences of that. When we start thinking, what if I'm like this forever? Or what if this pain never gets better or it never goes away? You know, when we're experiencing loss or difficulty, it can be really, really hard sometimes to rein all that back in and kind of remember that all those things aren't happening. Yeah, be in the moment where you are. And I just thought about this idea of panic and about how sometimes it's really easy to jump to a million extremes and start getting stuck all in the future and the future problems instead of being where you are. When I thought about the passage we're looking at today, we're continuing our journey through the book of John. And the sixth chapter of John's gospel records for us the miracle of the feeding of 5,000 men. And as we continue our study of this gospel, we got to keep a few concepts in mind. First, the purpose of John's gospel is to cause people to believe that Jesus is the Christ, the Son of God, and that by believing you might have life, according to John 20, verse 31. Second, the way John's been showing that Jesus is the Son of God is by revealing how Jesus does what God does. We were introduced to this concept in the very first words of the book. In the beginning was the Word. This is almost the same as the introduction to the book of Genesis. In the beginning, God created the heavens and the earth. John makes this equalness, this equation that Jesus is God because he was in the beginning just like God the Father. Third, John emphasizes signs. John only records 7 miracles that he calls signs, and we're not supposed to simply be wowed by these miracles, but to ask, what is the spiritual meaning behind these miracles? Because they are signs. They are signs pointing to something or communicating something to us. And we're dealing with one of those today in John chapter 6, verses 1 through 15. There we go. So I'm going to go ahead and read verses 1 through 15, and that's going to be our primary passage today, so we'll just kind of stay in that. But starting in chapter 6, verse 1 of the book of John, it says, "After this, Jesus went away to the other side of the Sea of Galilee, which is the Sea of Tiberias. And a large crowd was following him because they saw the signs he was doing on the sick. Jesus went up on the mountain, and there he sat down with his disciples. Now the Passover, the feast of the Jews, was at hand. Lifting up his eyes then and seeing that a large crowd was coming towards him, Jesus said to Philip, 'Where are we going to buy bread so that these people may eat?' And he said this to test him, for he himself knew what he would do. And Philip answered him, 200 denarii would not be worth of bread would not be enough for each of them to get a little. One of the disciples, Andrew, Simon Peter's brother, said to him, 'There's a boy here who's got 5 loaves and 2 fish, but what are they for so many?' And Jesus said, 'Have the people sit down.' Now there was much grass in the place, so the men sat down, about 5,000 in number. And Jesus then took the loaves, and when he had given them thanks, he distributed them to those who were seated, so also the fish, as much as they wanted. And when they had eaten their fill, he told the disciples, 'Gather up the leftover fragments, that nothing may be lost.' So they gathered them up and filled 12 baskets with fragments from the 5 barley loaves left by those who had eaten. And when the people saw the sign, what he had done, they said, 'This is indeed the prophet who is to come into the world.' Perceiving then that they were about to come and take him by force to make him king, Jesus withdrew again to the mountain by himself." Now, we look at this miracle, and it's interesting to consider. This is the only miracle that is recorded in all 4 Gospels. All the Gospel authors use this miracle to show us Jesus and to prove who he is. And the goal with this is not really to try and harmonize these, like to make all these Gospel accounts fit together. Rather, the goal is supposed to be about noticing what makes this account distinct. You know, if God wanted us to have one gospel, he would have given us one instead of these 4 different viewpoints. So when we're reading this story in John, we want to figure out what makes John's account different. What is John trying to teach us when he records this story? Now, the Exodus overtones in this story are really strongly highlighted. He really shows how this kind of is similar to some of the things that Moses has done, what Jesus does here. Notice in verse 4 that John tells us that the Passover was near, which is a memorial for the Exodus from Egyptian slavery. And notice the imagery that John gives us that the other Gospels don't. which point to Exodus. Number one, Jesus crosses the sea and goes up on the mountain. Jesus is mimicking what Moses did in the Exodus when he crossed the sea and went up into Mount Sinai. Number two, a large multitude is following Jesus across the sea. But only Jesus goes up to the mountain with his disciples, just like only Moses went up to the mountain. They are in the wilderness after crossing the sea. We know that the east side of the Sea of Galilee had barren hillsides. They're in a desolate place, unable to go and buy bread anywhere, as indicated by Jesus' question of where are we to buy bread? There's nowhere to do this. And number four, John's Gospel is the only account where Jesus asks the question, where are we to buy bread? In all the other accounts, the disciples initiate this question, and Jesus tells them to feed the people. Consider that the Exodus reenactment is kind of continuing because Moses says almost the exact same thing in Numbers 11, verse 13, when the people are looking for food. He says, where can I get meat for all these people, to God, when he's talking to him in Numbers, and the people there are looking for food. And as we study this sixth chapter of John, the gospel really wants you to firmly have in your mind that what Jesus is doing is like a new Exodus, that Jesus is this new, better teacher than Moses. And just like with the Exodus, he's teaching these people new, important lessons. These events are being paralleled to the Passover, the Exodus from Egypt, the going up onto Mount Sinai, the going into the wilderness. And the story also kind of gives us a warning about future trouble. Notice in verse 2, the large crowd was following him. Why are they following Jesus? Because they saw the signs that he was doing on the sick. The crowds were following him because they saw the signs he was doing. We had observed that this has been a problem through the Gospel of John. This becomes a difficulty for Jesus. And we first see it in John chapter 2, verses 23 through 25. Many believed when they saw the signs that he was doing, but Jesus did not believe in or entrust himself to them, because though they believed, he knew what was in their hearts. They weren't following him for the right reasons. The signs were meant to be followed so that saving faith would be initiated, so that there would be a change within them. That's the purpose of these signs. And it's not really changing all these people. They're supposed to grow and believe and change and take action in their lives. And Jesus condemns specifically in John chapter 4, verse 48, people that aren't really believing in him, but only focusing on these signs. He says, unless you see signs and wonders, you're not going to believe. John's shown us the false, non-saving belief of somebody like Nicodemus and the Pharisee in chapter 3, or the Pharisees in chapter 3, and the true saving faith of someone like the Samaritan woman in chapter 4, verse 2, kind of sets the tone for this chapter of how these crowds stand with Jesus and what they're going to do. They're following him for the signs, but they're not really listening to him. They're not really making this change. They're focused on worldly things. And so Jesus asked Philip, as the people are coming to meet them, where are we to buy bread so that these people may eat? I'd like for you to visualize the enormity of this problem. Jesus is testing Philip. I like that, or Andrew, or no, it's Philip. Yeah, I like that the Bible specifically clarifies Jesus asked him this to test him. And just imagine like sitting with Jesus and seeing a full like stadium worth of people. I think your average like college football stadium sits about 15 to 20,000. I may be completely off, but like around that. And that's probably about how many people are headed this way. It's 5,000 men. Likely their families are with them. And that's a lot more than 5,000 if you're just counting the men. So this is a huge, huge number of people. They're sitting on the mountain. They can see all these people coming. And Jesus asks, all right, where are we going to get bread to feed these people? Jesus knows what he's about to do. He's got a plan, but he wants to see how his disciples will answer. He wants to test their faith and the strength of that faith in him. Now, the hope would be that the disciples would turn to Jesus and declare, well, Jesus, you're the Son of God. You can do all things. I've seen you do all kinds of miracles. Can't you do something about this? Don't you have a solution? Don't you have a plan? That would be a great time to confess their faith, to put their trust in him. But rather than looking to Jesus for the answer and trusting him to provide, the disciples kind of look at themselves and they go, well, we don't have anything to fix this problem, Jesus. We ain't got enough money to handle this. We don't have enough food to solve the situation. And Jesus is not asking them to solve the problem. He's trying to get them to see him as the problem solver. You know, we're not supposed to look at our lives and determine that we've got to fix all the world's troubles ourselves, all of our difficulties and our flaws and everything all by ourselves. Rather, we're supposed to look at our lives and like the disciples were supposed to here, look at Christ and go, he's the one that can help me to deal with this. We're supposed to see our insufficiency, our flaws and failures when we look at ourselves. And remember how Jesus is the one who can help us to deal with those flaws, to overcome them. How easy it is to fail like the disciples here in refusing to see that we're joined to the one who can provide us with what we need. And so Jesus instructs the disciples to have the crowd sit down. And I like that it says they sat on the grass. You know, this is mostly a barren area, but they are apparently in one of the nicer spots in it. And I don't think that's a throwaway statement. It kind of makes me feel like, you know, in a region filled with barren rolling hills, where Jesus is, there's life. You know, it's like this is what it's like to be around Jesus. Even in this fairly desolate place, Jesus can find a place of comfort. And with these five small loaves and these two small fish available, Jesus takes them and gives thanks to the Father and manages to somehow, it is not explained to us, distribute enough bread and fish to feed 5,000 men and an unknown number of women and children. And then the disciples begin to hand out all this food. The 12 pass out the food they can carry. They come back to Jesus. They get more. They pass it out. And they keep passing out food to the crowds, eating as much as they wanted. And this is not a snack or dinner. This is dinner for the crowd. You know, it's not. I went to a wedding yesterday, one of my good friends, and you know, the wedding, they had kind of a finger food selection. But this ain't like a small finger food selection. This is like it's a huge amount of food. There's enough that there's quite a bit left over. The crowd eats until they're satisfied because Jesus can offer what's going to satisfy us. There's nothing lost. Another unique part of John's account of this sign is this command in verse 12. Jesus instructs the disciples, gather up the leftover fragments that nothing may be lost. And I think a lot of the time people kind of go the wrong way with this statement. I don't think that Jesus is focused so much on how God's abundant provision is not an excuse to waste resources, as one writer said. I don't think it's about trying to conserve what we've got or not wasting resources. But I think in spiritual terms, what John is teaching is that the bread that Jesus gives is enough for everyone. That's been the whole point of this lesson, is Jesus can provide enough. And I think it's really interesting how many baskets are left over. It's not 10, it's not 8, it's 12. Why are there 12 baskets? A lot of people believe these represent the tribes of Israel. Jesus has come so that none in Israel would be lost. He's come to offer them life, to save them from their sins. He's chosen these 12 men to go help teach these 12 tribes. And John identifies in verse 14 that there's a deeper message to this than the mere fact that Jesus used his power to fill bellies. Something greater is being taught, and this message sets the tone for the rest of this chapter as we're going to be looking at it, where Jesus will declare himself to be the bread of life. Jesus has come so that all can be fed spiritually. He's come to gather Israel in for its salvation, and all who are gathered to him will get what they need. And the people understand this symbolic connection to the Passover and the Exodus. In verse 14, the crowd declares that Jesus is the prophet that Moses spoke about. If you go back to Deuteronomy in chapter 18, verses 15 through 19, Moses talks about how another prophet's going to come that's like him. And the people see what Jesus has done, how he's led them into this place in the middle of the wilderness and got them all the food they needed, just like Moses did when he was leading the people. And they go, oh man, he's the prophet Moses spoke of. He's the guy. He should be our king, our new leader. But rather than coming to Jesus as the giver of life, the one who satisfies all that they need, they come to him and they want to make him a political figure. They saw the sign but drew the wrong conclusion about what this meant. They didn't come to him for salvation or to rule over the sin in their lives, but they want to see him once again, the thing we've seen over and over again in the Gospel of John, they're concerned about this worldly thing. They see, this is a man that can fix our earthly problem, our hunger, our difficulties, our issues with the Romans. They're focused on physical and material things rather than their spiritual health. And when Jesus offers the woman at the well water, that will become a fountain of living water, she does the same thing. She says, "Sir, give me this water that I'll be thirsty and I have to come to draw water." She thinks of her physical comfort. It'd be great not to have to draw water out of the well anymore. When Jesus feeds the 5,000, they want to make him their physical king who will give them what they want. But we see the points clearly stated in verse 26, a little bit farther down in John 6. It says, "For as the Father has life in himself, so he's granted the Son also to have life in himself." This is why Jesus withdraws from them and returns to the mountain, because just as when Moses came down from Mount Sinai with the tablets of stone, only to find the people acting sinful and return to the mountain to receive the law again, Jesus is trying to show these guys that he's the source of life, that he's got what they need, and they miss the point. Jesus has come to be their lasting, eternal satisfaction. And the people just want something to fix the problem today. And we'll leave that thought there and consider it in greater depth for future lessons in this chapter, as Jesus is going to explore this problem in their hearts. But I thought about this passage, and I thought about some of my own experiences. When I was in college, I went to counseling, which was extremely helpful. And I learned something important in counseling, and it was about panic. I'm a panicker. Any of you that have talked to me very much, you've probably noticed this. I'm a rather frantic fellow sometimes. I kind of run around real fast and kind of look panicked. But I was talking to my counselor, and he said, "All right, John, I noticed your problem. You get out of your own context a lot. Instead of living where you are and dealing with your immediate issue, whatever that might be, it might be very difficult. I was dealing with social anxiety at the time. I was rather awkward. I know y'all can't believe that, but in college, not now, in college, I was awkward. I'm not that way anymore. But I was dealing with anxiety, and I was like, I don't know how to go up to people and talk to them, man. I panic, and I just start rambling, and I just go, go, go." And he said, "All right, calm down." He said, "You need to figure out a way to not let your anxiety run you over. So let me give you a help. Take your hand, put it in front of your face, take 5 things you believe to be true. You know, your mom loves you, your sisters love you, God loves you, Jesus is your Savior, the church is your family. We'll call it that. And whenever you start panicking, look at your hand, look at those 5 things, and repeat them, 1 for each finger, until you calm down a little bit and kind of remember where you are and stop running off into possibilities and concerns." I tell you that story to tell you, I think so often panic kind of gets us away from where we actually are and what Jesus can actually do for us. The disciples see this problem and it gets so big and they think, "Well, Jesus, we can't fix this. How are we supposed to deal with this? You know, we're just people." Instead of looking at Jesus and going, "Okay, well, that's a big problem, but also Jesus is right here, and I have seen him do like crazy stuff. He can help me." I think what we're supposed to learn from this test is that faith is about not panicking and running away from God, but about looking to him in our struggle and getting some comfort from the only one that can give comfort. You know, whether it's pain or loss or sickness or any of those things, we can't necessarily control that or change that, but we're not alone in it. And remembering that can give us a little strength and peace, or at least that's my hope, because Jesus is the one who can give any strength or peace that we can hope to find. How often God tests us to see if we're gonna trust him. You know, is it on our lips that God can do anything? God uses us and tests us to accomplish his purposes, but I think about how often we kind of panic and believe we can't do anything, or we lose our faith. We're off looking at how impossible things are and failing to see that the arm of God's not short. He's not leaving us to do these things on our own. We've got to have the heart to trust the Lord in all things and look at him in every circumstance, whether good or bad. Because if we don't, we're going to be trying to do it by ourselves, and we just can't. We need to hear and believe the words of the apostles and their faith in Christ, that he is the Son of God, about what they've written down for us. His divine power has given us everything we need for a godly life through our knowledge of him who calls us by his own glory and goodness. That's what Peter said, who was there that day in 2 Peter chapter 1 and verse 3. I wonder if Peter learned that from this occasion, that instead of being the kind of person that was panicking like Philip was here or like Andrew was here, Peter writes and says, I've learned that God's given us all we need for a godly life, that he's enough. Everything we need so that no one can be lost, so that all can find a king who can take care of us, who can supply our needs, who can fill us up when we need him. This morning, I don't know what your struggle is, what your worry, your difficulty is, but I know that sometimes they can look very, very large. They can overwhelm you. They can seem to beat you up. And I just want you to know you're not alone in whatever struggle it is, that God is with you and he can help you, and that we as the church want to be with you and help you any way we can. We are God's people. We're a family together. And as God's family, we want to welcome anybody that needs to be a part of that family. So if you're a Christian today, if you need prayer or help or anything we can do, we want to pray with you. And if you're not a Christian, you want to become part of that family, you want some people that love you and care about you, a God that loves you, we'll be happy to make you make that change. If there's anything we can do for you today, come as we stand and as we sing.